Hello and welcome to the Cube Pod, episode 54. I'm John Furrier with Dave Vellante, the Cube host. We extract the signal from the noise every week. This is our podcast. We break down what we're working on, what we're seeing, what we're doing. Obviously, we're kicking off event season. We just came back from an amazing week at Google Next 24. Dave had some real proprietary NDA meetings with some of the big players in the industry around the country. And of course, we're digging into all the research on SiliconANGLE. Rob Hope and the team there doing a great job. And the Cube research continues to put out great content. Dave, great to see you.
Hey, John.
We're kicking everything off. Again, the season starts, but what a week. You can hear in my voice, I'm a little bit tired from just really kind of cranking hard at Google Next. We did like 40 interviews. We have over almost 50 interviews and over 500, videos we produced. I think SiliconANGLE has over 30 articles posted and more coming. Just a barrage of content. I did a segment on the New York Stock Exchange. We did a live remote. Just Google Cloud kicked ass. We're going to dig into that. Andy Jassy was on CNBC. You saw the interview. I could not get it because it's on the pro login. I did see a clip from Brad Gerster from one Altimeter Capital had a post around his really, strong posture against the regulation. And he used iRobot as an example. I know you want to talk about it. I do too, but you watched it. So I know we have thoughts on that. So
yeah,
that's, we make sure we hit that hard. Intel had an event and basically all the analysts blew off Intel and they came to Google Next. So you saw a lot of people either not go to Intel's event or just snuck out the back door. Okay. Did an Irish exit, as we say. And so Intel's got challenges there and they continue to try to polish up their, position, which is not good. TSMC, I think, outplayed them again. This week with their funding from the government. Intel got their subsidy, and TMC is investing more. So we'll see what Gaudi does. Gaudi 3 is a 7-nanometer, Davis. It's starting out behind. And I want to get into this because I did some research on this. Okay. Talked to a lot of experts on this. Gaudi 3 might not make it. Okay. It might be a little too late and a dollar short, or in this case, nanometer short, too big. We're going to get into the energy aspect of it. And also people are smoking, you know what, when they get the benchmarks. Had a great conversation at Google Next around how people are sandbagging the performance numbers with the new tokens. So in AI, it's all about how many tokens per second can you do? Well, guess what? There's now controversy brewing around tokens per second because you can juice the tokens number with more energy. So we're going to get into that. Cybersecurity consolidation, big blowback from our segment last week where you introduced the paper with Microsoft. That's interesting. And just a lot of news from Google Next that surprised me. And we'll get into that. But it's just an unbelievable week. And the whole team is cranking. I mean, the Google story is just off the charts. Maybe there's more than 30. But you're seeing the enhancements. And a surprise note, and I knew it was around that time, but it was actually an event in Vegas with Google Next. This is the 10-year anniversary on June 6th where Kubernetes was launched. First commit was June 6th. So unbelievable. Time flies, Dave. Remember when we were sitting there saying, hey, we're going to make a bet on Kubernetes. This is going to be big. This is going to be the glue that unifies the industry. We don't want another OpenStack. We want to see something. And we made a bet. We went to every single KubeCon. We invested our own money into the community and got to meet those people that were starting it. And there was some stop starts and risk, almost didn't make it. Those people are now running senior positions in the industry, and Kubernetes has been such a big success all around. I will get
and you and you and Stu were there, right? I think you were there with Stu. Weren't you there when Kubernetes was announced at like DockerCon?
Stu, Miniman, and I, he and Red Hat former Cube host, everyone knows Stu. Stu and I were having beers with Lou Tucker and JJ, who runs OSS Venture Capital Firm, and the other guy from Kismatic. I forgot his name. And it was talking about the Google paper and spitting that out. And even before that, our first ever Google event, when the App Engine was around with Craig McLuckie, Brendan Burns, and Tim Hocken, and all the Google people were like the nerds working on this. I ended up going to their after-hours party, and we're all sitting there drinking. They didn't know I was with SiliconANGLE or theCUBE at the time. And I just sitting there. They thought I was a Googler. I fit in. And they were riffing about how Eric Schmidt was killing the whole initiative. and that they did not want Kubernetes to be another MapReduce. If you remember the MapReduce paper, Dave, they took that out and made Cloudera. They're like, we do not want to see the same thing happen to Kubernetes. We don't want some company to hijack it and then make a business out of it, which Cloudera did, which that was a smart move, by the way, by Cloudera, because Google just gave it to them. So it almost got killed. Kubernetes was almost killed before it even started. So great little legacy in story, but
interesting. Great
10-year anniversary. They had a big party, big cake. Really, really cool to see, you know, all the...
I would go so far as to say that if Google didn't open source Kubernetes and give that gift to the world, it would have been completely irrelevant in the cloud. We all know it's a distant third, but, you know, we'll talk about this, but, you know, the AI is changing the game. And so they're new game, new rules. Kubernetes, Google would have been just completely irrelevant.
Well, the entire cloud native industry might not have been relevant because it basically creates the enablement for things like more container usage, serverless. Kubernetes is a really important technology that has made cloud native really work at cloud scale. So you saw that really, 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 really prominent at Google Next. It was really interesting to see that, but all good. I don't want to get too fast into Google, but I want to just make sure I hit all our topics for this podcast. The Intel, TSMC investment was big. We want to start with the Andy Jassy interview.
Let me make a quick comment on TSMC. So
let's start there first.
They got their subsidy, but to me, the big thing, you know, watching some of the vision stuff, you talk about Gaudi. They were comparing Gaudi performance to, you know, last generation NVIDIA chips. Even NVIDIA does some benchmarking. You know, if we read the semi analysis they just did, which was outstanding on Blackwell, you know, even they're playing games. But here's the thing: IDC just put out a report. PC volume is going to grow 1.5% this year. Okay, Intel's monopoly is from PCs. PCs peaked in 2011. They're now back to pre-pandemic highs, only going to grow 1.5%. Why is that important? That means for Foundry to succeed, they're not going to get volume from their own x86 PC business. The only way they're going to get volume is if they steal major share from TSM and Samsung. So I think the probability that they're going to steal major share, enough share to drive volume, to drive their costs down, to get their yields up, it's a very, very high bar for Intel. And I think it's a relatively low probability that they're going to surpass Samsung and get to a confident number two by the end of the decade, which is their goal.
Well, what do you think about the 7-nanometer announcement? I mean, Gaudi is starting out like a leg behind. It's almost like playing with one leg, right?
So it's like
compared to 5-nanometer and 3-nanometer, and their benchmarks were comparing, as you pointed out, old NVIDIA benchmarks. So the not yet even released Intel chip is already claiming that it's better than a multi-year-old NVIDIA chip, which when the new chip comes out will be completely different from a both nanometer perspective, energy management perspective. Just overall, everything's different. So is it okay to have a 7-nanometer chip? Who cares?
I'm not an expert on this, but I have been told by people who are that it's hard to compare, you know, Intel's, you know, process at 7 with others at 5 or 3, that there are significant differences. I think Intel is trying to leapfrog, play what Floyer calls is, you know, parlor tricks to try to catch up, five nodes in 4 years. I think I'll give them a pass on that. But again, it just comes down to volume. How does Intel get volume? The monopoly is basically gone. The monopoly is gone. They no longer have a monopoly. You know, as in the monopoly is NVIDIA. We can talk about that. But then I just think, I've said it before, I'll say it again. I think if Gina Raimondi's objective is U.S. Access to onshore advanced chips, the higher probability is to invest more in those that actually are delivering those advanced chips, i.e. Samsung and TSM in particular. But both of those companies are investing in the United States, And so they're, I feel like they're watering down the investments, our tax dollars, a little bit too thinly. I want to see Intel succeed. Don't get me wrong. It pains me to say this, but the question is it more important to have a US-based supply, or is it more important to have a US-based manufacturer? And that's not necessarily an easy question to answer, yeah, right. But I would say the former is probably more important than the latter.
Well, Intel has always been secret. Recently, Intel is very secretive. They're like, everything's scripted. That's a red flag as far as I'm concerned. So I'm very skeptical on Intel right now. I don't have a good vibe on them. I see them, you know, groping for relevance, obviously getting lapped around the field by the competition. And the TSMC Arizona win, not only on the grant from the U.S. government, but their own investment. They're winning. And whoever gets on their plate ends up probably having the best chips. Everyone's designing custom silicon. We saw the ARM Google announcement. So I think TSMC is continuing to kick ass, and that's not good news for Intel. But you know, since you brought up Intel and the policy side of it, the government subsidies or the government handouts, what should we call it? Government funding? What are they calling it on paper in the press release?
The CHIPS Act is obviously a strategic move to bolster, you know, U.S. manufacturing capability and supply of advanced chips, but it's very clearly a subsidy for Intel. But, you know, in fairness, they're spreading money around. Samsung's getting money, and
would you call it a handout?
TSM. But I call it a handout. I mean, yeah, it is a handout. It's a taxpayer handout. But I mean, I don't think it's the wrong thing to do, by the way. You know, but I will say
this. It's not an entitlement. It's an investment. Investment, whatever you want to call it. And they have to produce. And your question is a good one. Can they even deliver?
But I'll say this, John. $52 billion, $50 billion is a drop in the bucket. You know, you hear numbers like, you know, trillions of dollars thrown around. The likes of Google, Amazon, Apple, who are all, you know, big Meta, big players in this game, big consumers of chips. You know, we're talking, they're trying to build, we heard this at Broadcom, million GPU clusters. Okay, these are big consumers of chips. They also make their own chips. All three of the big hyperscalers do. And they have so much money on their balance sheet. They could easily write a $100 billion check to bolster US-based manufacturing. They could. And I think the smart thing for the U.S. government to do would be, look, we're going to dial down all the rhetoric around like not letting you buy, you know, iRobot.
Let me just finish that thought.
And you know what? But you guys got to step up and start writing some checks for U.S. competitiveness in the semiconductor business. So let's start figuring out a way to do that is additive, you know, long-term to their balance sheets, and at the same time, additive to U.S. competitive, and doesn't necessarily take taxpayer dollars. They've got so much money, they don't know what to do with it. So they're buying GPUs. Anyway,
we'll get into the GPU architecture later with Google Next conversation, because they had a lot that they announced. Let's get into Andy Jassy and Amazon Web Services. First, Andy Jassy had a couple things happen this week. One, he had the shareholder letter that went out. And then he was on CNBC for an interview, and he was very vocal. And by the way, I give him amazing props for what he did. That takes leadership, and that takes guts, okay? And it was ironic, at Google, the new head of public sector, within the first couple of minutes of the interview, she brought up China directly, volunteered it. We are not doing business in China. This is from the CEO of Google Public Sector. And by the way, has Kevin Mandian on her board. So I'm learning a lot of new things. We'll get that in a second, but this China rhetoric is huge. Andy Jassy basically said, he basically said to the world, look, we tried to buy a company. We thought there was synergies, and it got rejected in the EU, and the U.S. told us they would reject it too. And because two Chinese companies were the competitors, and they were worried about us having unfair business practices. Meanwhile, in order to do the product that they make, you have to have data on everyone's home, right? And so you don't trust an American company, but yet you'll trust these Chinese companies. And he was blatant. He said abuse of the law.
Yeah. So
okay, that was massive. And I think that's leadership. If people are throwing haymakers at him, that's hypocritical Amazon, because always the haters of Amazon. But he's stepped up.
Oh, that 100%, awesome. John. I gotta add to that. So basically, let me double click on it. So the right, they blocked the iRobot acquisition. And so Andy's point was, when you have these Chinese manufacturers, these home vacuum cleaners, they have to map out your home, right?
Yeah.
They're collecting all the data on your home, and you're trusting them. And yet at the same time, you don't trust us and you're blocking this acquisition. It's really absurd. And then he did make the statement that they're overstepping their bounds and they're probably not following the law. I hope they challenge that in court. The problem is the current sentiment within this administration is to just pretty much block everything, which is to me, it's just swung too far. So that the other thing I would add, I put out a tweet on this. Andy Jassy did exactly what we said he was going to do with Amazon. People were calling for his head last 2022. You remember? Yeah. Oh, how long is Jassy going to last here? We were like, wait a minute. The guy just took over. You know, he took over and the market was booming. So they had to hire people like crazy during COVID. You couldn't even get toilet paper. So they had to like figure out the supply chain, hire people like it. So they, of course they overhired, and then Ukraine hits, interest rates start going up. The Fed starts tightening like overnight. So, you know, you just can't just turn around the steamship. But what they did was remarkable. The stock's at an all-time high today. They've got liquidity in the balance sheet. AWS is kicking ass, even though you read Charles Fitzgerald, you think they're about to go under. Fitzy's like out of control with his vitriol against anything that's not Microsoft, but he's funny as hell. But at any rate, Jassy did exactly what we said he was going to do. He was going to cut costs, naturally. He was going to make sure that the retail business started cranking again. He's doing media deals. Thursday Night Football is a huge win for those guys. He's got advertising revenue kicking in. He's taken over AI, basically helping Adam, you know, figure that out because it's so important. And Amazon is, you know, is back with enormous runway. So kudos to him. Great leadership. Everything we thought he would do and more, John.
Yeah. Well, I like the fact that he stood tall and he said what was on everyone's mind. And he's obviously listening to the podcast because he basically said what we've been saying in so many words. But he did it in a way that was very respectful. He was very opinionated, but he brought up the entrepreneurial equation. And to me, what resonates in that his little diatribe with the New York Times reporter or CNBC reporter is he used an example. He says, look, that's not our model to go do people. Try to screw people over. I saw us sell more stuff. And yeah, we offer third party. But his real point was iRobot suffered. They didn't make it. They weren't going to make it. You had Chinese competition. That's we know in China, there's no entrepreneurial action. It's all controlled by the government. It's all the whole system works as one. The state runs everything. So you have two companies that are scaling up and using all their anti-capitalism to have a competitive advantage over the American company. And so he basically saying this is an entrepreneurial success story. They started a company, created so much value, and then had competition. And Amazon synergies would have put them into more competitive synergies on leverage, on scale, and supplier components, etc. And then they reject it. The company lays off a third of its staff. Stock price tanks. It essentially goes into a tailspin. And Dave, you know, we always say in the queue, when the boat starts taking on water, it's hard to really make it work. And sometimes it's irrecoverable. You can't recover from that when the boat starts sinking or the plane starts going to a tailspin. So that was really the problem. And that bothers me because I think that's the government that is saying we would rather see entrepreneurship fail over some hypothetical scenario of a company's intentions. Okay, that I have a problem with right there. So I think, you know, Jassy's standing up for all the entrepreneurs out there and people who start businesses. It's hard to start a business, hard to run a business. And, right. and you know, yeah, did they do anything wrong? Nothing wrong. It was a good deal.
So
it's the China angle. And that's the whole point. The U.S. government is so clueless on this. But the regulators.
To your point, it's like the tale of the parable of the Chinese farmer. You know that where his horse runs away and they say, oh, sorry. He goes, oh, maybe. Then a horse brings back, comes back with seven other horses. Yeah, that's great. He goes, oh, maybe. And then the son breaks his arm. Oh, that's terrible. And then this, you know, you've heard that parable, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. And but the point is there are these unintended consequences of these decisions that it's really hard to predict. And so, okay, great. So you hurt an American company. you're essentially helping these Chinese companies with your public policy. Is that the outcome that you're intending? Really? And so I feel like it's really hard for the government to predict the impact of their actions. And you know, who knows, John, maybe AI will be smarter than the government soon and they'll be able to figure it out. I'm really disappointed in the public-private partnership and the discontinuities between, on the one hand, we want to be more competitive, and you hear things like, you know, tariffs against China. And on the other hand, we're just constricting business, trying to do regulatory capture in certain industries, which doesn't really work out that well. But yeah, back to Jassy, he was stellar. And I thought Andrew Ross Sorkin was excellent. I thought he did a really, really good job.
He does good interviews. He consistently asks the right questions. He obviously does his homework, which is awesome. But, you know, the Lina Khan at the FTC, the problem is that, you know, in the AI conversations, not to bring back into AI, because like I said on theCUBE, we're AI drunk these days. Everything's about generative AI. We have an era where there's massive societal change going on and shift. And people like Lina Khan, who's at the FTC, really is not plugged into what's going on in the world. And because technology is not this evil section of people or section of industry where there's evil people trying to screw people over. It's becoming pervasive in everything we do. So the number one conversation with generative AI is societal change. Better government, be a better government, be a better provide to your to citizens better services, to streamlining antiquated systems, to the public sector, to offering entrepreneurship opportunities, and also democratization. Dave, you know, AI is a technology that will, if handled properly and not regulated and killed by narrow-minded people like Lina Khan, is to say, hey, you know, people can level up. You know, you can have someone with a degree in Harvard and someone who never went to college can level up within months and be peers. Okay, we're talking about the biggest democratization opportunity in our history. So the whole idea of, you know, underrepresented minorities getting a fair shot, getting access, these are things that we work on. The opportunity is now for that. And I think, you know, the stuff's changing so fast that you're having some pedigree or having some status, elite status or privilege could be at risk tomorrow because the opportunities are everywhere. And the ability to capture those opportunities is available. And the skills to do it are the same for any people. So to me, that's a big problem. And so my rant is that the regulation of AI, the other side of the coin of safety is what opportunity costs are being blown by trying to regulate something that's not well known. You don't know the outcome. You can't make optimal decisions. It's like a startup. It's always hard, and you got to keep iterating with the decisions. You can't figure out unknowns that are evolving. So
I think the problem I have, the biggest problem I have with Lina Khan is she's trying to rewrite the law through her public policy, at least how I interpret the law. The history of the DOJ and the FTC meddling in tech is frankly very poor. That markets generally moderate the technology monopolies, and market forces have done a much better job, in my opinion, than the government. Now, having said that, if a monopoly is colluding, or they're bundling, or they have practices that hurt consumers, that's breaking the law. But essentially what she's doing is saying, if there's a potential for those things, we are going to declare monopoly and then we're going to take action. So there's a big difference between these things are actually happening and they have the potential to happen. And I think that she's conflating them. And I think that's where Jassy is right, that she's overstepping her legal boundaries. And it's, you know, to me, it's very disappointing.
All right. Well, let's get into while we have Andy Jassy on the docket here. And by the way, we should ping him and get him on the podcast. I'm going to reach out to him and see if he comes on and kind of have a Elon Musk moment for us, how he made remember Joe Rogan and had Elon Musk on and everyone went crazy. So we should try to see if we can lure Andy on to do us a favor and come on and share his thoughts. Let's get into his dear shareholder letter. They had the annual letter. It's a tradition that Jeff Bezos started. Now that Andy's the CEO, took it over. You read it. What'd you think? Things jumped out. Obviously, the numbers are incredible. But they overspent in the pandemic. He told me that when I last time I met with him in November with a hockey game, he said, "Yeah, we spent a lot. We built up. We didn't know it was going to end."
So, well, but plus they were responding to customer demand. I mean, what are they going to do? Not respond? Look at his shareholder letter. It was really upbeat versus the last year, which was, you know, hey, we got some challenges and we're going to take them on. He basically did everything he said he's going to do and more. To me, it's just, it was upbeat.
People are saying they're cutting back, though. That's my point. My point is that they got to cut back. They have to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, people are always going to complain at those things. They've cut back in AWS, cutting back on CapEx, which, of course, you know, Charles Pitts is like, oh, see, they're in trouble.
If you overspend, if you overspend, Dave, then, you know, it's like,
right,
you got to claw it back.
So to me, briefly, the combination of what's happening at AWS or Amazon, you know, retail and AWS, you know, coming into play. Now, AWS has its own challenges that we should talk about that, but their businesses are humming, and that's why the stock's at an all-time high again, which we were saying when the stock was getting beat up and everybody was like, oh, wow, Amazon's done. Could be a buying opportunity. Again, we don't advise stocks. Be careful. Do your own research. We're not, stock advisors. But, you know, we do watch companies and we watch fundamentals and we know good management when we see it. The one thing I would say, so AWS, I think it would be really interesting to see if they can accelerate growth as a result of AI. We should talk about their AI strategy. He did say, he said now a number of times, and he said in his letter that cost optimization has attenuated. That doesn't mean it's gone away. And I tweeted out some data. Cost optimization, it's like muscle memory in golf. You know, you hit that shot, you know, I don't really know that well, but you know, when you hit that shot, you're like, okay, I got this down now. And it becomes like your best shot, your go-to shot with your 7-iron. You can always hit it. Like I've seen you hit it, boom. I'm like, you can't miss. It's unbelievable. So you got that muscle memory. Well, I think that's what cost optimization is like now. The IT buyers and Amazon customers, cloud customers, they have muscle memory on cost optimization. They say, hey, we know how to do this. Let's do that. Now, a lot of people think, oh, that's bad for the cloud companies. It's not bad. Here's why. What they do is then they save money. This market's always been elastic. I've just never had the data on cloud, but now I do, and I'm seeing it. When prices go down, when cost goes down on something that's valuable, like technology, they spend more. And that's what happens. They'll invest more and they'll invest more for innovation. So when I've seen this for years with storage, cost per bit would go down. People would buy more. Why? Because we can store more. We can do more data and analytics on that. It's the same thing's happening with cloud resources. You're going to see the same thing happen with GPUs. Costs go down, people will consume more. Now, is it a straight line up? No, it goes in step functions and it goes up and down. It's not always a pretty straight line. That's how markets work. And so he did call that out, but I think that there is a gain sharing going on with that muscle memory, meaning people are taking money from their savings and they're putting it into AI, and they're also taking it from other places and putting it in AI. That's clearly what the data shows.
Yeah, I agree. And one of for me, what jumped out at this letter was a very long letter. It's on their website. They've been cutting back, but their delivery times are up. That's a big deal for Amazon, is delivery times. The emphasis on Prime, again, with the original content, is core. You mentioned Thursday Night Football. They got programs. They had that successful Boys in the Boat movie that was phenomenal. Just hit. That should win awards. I thought that was a phenomenal movie. But their advertising business, Dave, is growing. So you don't think about Amazon as an advertising company. So what you're going to see is, I think their whole TV offering is going to be disruptive. So let's keep an eye on that. I remember I had a one-on-one with Andy Jassy for a pre-reInvent briefing. And he's like, why do you love Twitch so much? I'm like, well, first of all, Twitch is huge. It's fun. It's gamers. But the numbers are massive. And then, you know, that was the beginning. They started getting into now they got freebie. They got the over the top. So you watch their free media. Remember, they bought MGM. So MGM Originals, all that stuff. AWS, we cover that like a blanket, so no need to go in there. The key is going to be there to see how their custom chips, will they have a lead on performance and will they drive that home? But I'm really fascinated by the Prime Video service.
Yeah,
that really got my attention. So, you know, advertising and Prime, They're in the entertainment business, right? And they went out the whole division document on primitives and primitive services, and then the
map. That was interesting. That's primitives conversation. So he applied that to Amazon.com. I found that really, because we've been talking about primitives in the cloud forever, for a decade. And we used to say, Andy, why don't you guys do more solutions? And he remember on theCUBE, and he said to us, look, guys, here's why. It gives us optionality and flexibility to move fast. And he was talking about primitives in the Amazon.com business. I loved that conversation.
Well, you know why they're doing it. Here's my first of all, this is my speculation. No one told me this. I'm just connecting the dots. It's an Amazon thing. And this is an Andy fingerprints are all over this. What he's doing here, he's cleverly tying together Amazon services so he can tee up that we have technology on Amazon. Because remember, Andy's been very vocal about, we've been doing machine learning for years. Now everyone says that now, David. You notice that? Everyone's like, oh, we've been doing machine AI for years. Before it was like all hyped up. I mean, that is.
We even biggest... say that, John. We even say that.
I thought about AI once. I programmed in Lisp in the 80s. That was AI. So I think what he's doing here is saying, look at Amazon as a company, including AWS, is using AI everywhere. Then they have been using data and machine learning. So this primitives is basically saying our cloud's been serving our existing business since it started. I mean, remember, Amazon Web Services started with one customer, Amazon.com. Okay. And they grinded their way through and iterated through and as a customer of themselves, Amazon Web Services became the behemoth that it is. So this primitives is basically saying, this is how we think about our business. And I guarantee you the next step's going to be tie that to machine learning and AI so they can go back to tell the world, hey, we are better than Microsoft and anyone else at AI. Now, Google is going to be a good company to watch when it comes to, is Amazon's AI better than Google?
Because before you go to Google, can I just say one last thing about Lena Khan? I just want to say something about Amazon. So the reason I get so pissed off about this is I think about Amazon. I think I'm like a loyal Amazon customer. Somebody told me one time years ago, you're a Prime member? I go, yeah, of course I'm a Prime member. They go, do you know that on average you spend like 20% more on products, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay. They said, would you ever give up your Prime? I'm like, no, never. My point is, I have choices. I can buy online from Walmart. I can buy online from 1,000 different places. But I personally trust Amazon. I know they're going to deliver. They're going to deliver fast. They freaking deliver on Sundays. If I have a problem, they fix the problem. You know, if I got the wrong thing or it's damaged, I send it back. They're great to do business with. So they're not hurting me as a consumer. I love the way they've, you know, helped my life. They've driven so much convenience to my life. So when I see like all this vitriol against Amazon, I'm like, look, you don't have to buy from them. Buy from somebody else. Drive to the store, whatever you want. But, you know, anyway, let's talk about Google.
No, I was segueing from where Google about the AI. Because Amazon, and Amazon Web Services, Amazon proper, they have done a lot of technology. So like to call them like falling behind is ridiculous. Now, Google has the same problem that Amazon has. They don't get credit in mainstream for all the work they've done. I mean, if it wasn't for Google, almost 90% of the AI success is probably due to the root back to the lineage. It's Google people. Google and Meta's trying to take credit for it now. They hired all the Google people. So Meta basically is a little mini Google in terms of the engineering prowess. It certainly didn't come from Zuckerberg. He wasn't like known for a great engineer. He's a great product guy and he can code PHP, but he's not the killer deep tech engineer. They've been poaching Google. They live it's a valley known public secret. Google DNA AI roots goes back to all the papers that were written. They've been doing it for many, many years. And it's in the company, Google Search and all the scale and everything they've done, like Amazon. So at Google Next, you saw them bring all that out. You saw Google Flex. And I said this many years ago, Dave, on theCUBE. Remember, we had a big session on this. We said, if they can get their act together and go back into the back room and get all the stuff and have someone organize it and just this department pull it from there and just get it into one coherent thing, they'd smoke everybody. Remember that conversation? Might have been like 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And when everyone's like, why isn't Google winning? They have large scale experience. They know how to deal with data at massive scale. They basically invented the SRE concept, and Borg, which is now Kubernetes, is they have all that. It's all coming from Google. So Google doesn't get enough credit, okay, in the industry. Insiders know it. In fact, there's a lot of poaching going on from Google, either people or the ideas. And half the OpenAI people used to work at Google or came from the DeepMind team. And so it's the creative process of Silicon Valley. It's the fertilizer is the people and the technology. So Google's been a big part of that. So I think Google and Amazon are going to really flex their AI. I think Microsoft right now is looking good if you look at from a leaderboard standpoint, from perception. But I'll tell you right now, the conversation I've been having with people in the trenches, startups, no one likes Azure, okay? They like Google. No one complains about, have you heard anyone complain about Google price?
No,
not really, ever.
And I have data on this too. I want to share it with you.
Yeah, please share. Because I'm telling you right now, they could make a really power move right now in terms of moving faster up the leaderboard or from the third place challenge position to a leadership position. And I'll tell you, they have the chops and they're bringing it. They're stacked right now.
So I just want to say something about, so when Frank Slootman took over for Snowflake, and I think he might've written about it in his book, but he told me this company Snowflake, they had product market fit like for years, but all they had to do was figure out the go-to-market. So I came in, I scaled go-to-market, and you know, you don't want to scale go-to-market until you have product market. But when you get product market fit, you want to scale your go-to-market. Well, Google's got product market fit, but they can't figure out the go-to-market and the service model. And they've struggled with that, right? Rob Enslin was kind of running sales at Google, and now he's at UiPath. And so they'll eventually figure it out. But the data that I have suggests that AI is really allowing them to close the gap. Not so much broadly in cloud, all right, but let's talk.
Let's talk
narrowly in AI. Okay, so when you look at the ETR data, and they have a very consistent time series methodology, which measures spending momentum on a platform. And spending momentum, it's only measured by percent of customers that are doing something. So it's just a percent customer measure. It's not a actual dollar measure. But it's called net score. Net score represents the net percent of customers that are spending more on a platform. So they ask a bunch of questions. Are you adding new? Are you spending more? Are you spending flat? Are you spending less? Or are you churning? And they take the lesses away from the mores, and that's net score, okay? And anything over 40% is exceedingly good, okay? So I just ran, before this QPod, I ran numbers, and I ran them back to January of 2022 for Google, AWS, and Microsoft. And the net score in just the machine learning and AI sector, the net score for Google was 61%, AWS 60%, Microsoft 71%. That's back in January 22. Now, the other thing they measure is how many people actually respond. Because the more people that respond, it's an indicator, a proxy for install base. So Google was at the time 93, AWS is 151, Microsoft 175, okay? So all three had very high net scores, a lot of spending momentum, but you know, relatively small ends, 93, 151, and 175 for Google, AWS, and Microsoft respectively. Now fast forward to April 24, the survey that just hit, okay? It's kind of quasi-public. Net scores, Google 56%, AWS 58%, so pretty comparable. Microsoft 74%. But check out the ends, the responses. Google 340, AWS 370, Microsoft 611. So what's happening is, let me explain this. What's happening is Microsoft has stayed elevated in terms of customer percentage, spending more, and even actually accelerate a little bit. Their numbers of N went through the roof because of, you know, Azure API, getting open API access. But Google and AWS have come together in terms of those N's. It was 93 versus 151. Now it's 340 versus 370. So you can do the math. But when you look at the data over time, and they have these graphs that, you know, they use Power BI, which kind of sucks, but it doesn't. You can see these coming together. And Google, and in MLAI, Google and AWS really on top of each other. So that says that Google is in the AI sector really catching up in terms of customer momentum and customer, you know, install base.
So to simplify that in my mind, because it's a lot of data there. I was trying to grok it. So is it Is the gap closing? And if you can scope it, scope the gap between two and three here between Amazon. How would you kind of scope that? And if you can scope between one and two, that'd be great as well.
Yeah. So
are we talking a horse length, multiple horse lengths? You know, horse racing.
Yeah. So lengths. Thing. So at, if you go back to January of 22, mm-hmm. 151 over 93. So there was 1.6. So Google or AWS had 1.6 more installations in this survey than did Google. And now when you do the math, it's 370 and 340, so it's 1.08. So basically, you know, you're talking about 60% lead down to an 8% lead. Okay, so, you know, if it's a horse race, the plotter at the back of the pack coming down, you know, the far turn, it's here comes Google on the outside, and he's and Google's going to the whip. You know, with a right-handed whip, as they say.
so they're in position. They have a shot of coming up faster than you think.
That's what the data says. No question about it. And of course, Microsoft, just because they're everywhere. Let me say this about the Microsoft interpreting the Microsoft data in these surveys. They're so ubiquitous. They're so large, and they have so many customers. They overwhelm the survey data. Whereas, you know, Google and AWS, it's a much more sort of apples to apples comparison.
So given that, I would say being at Google's event in Vegas this week, I would say that it's very clear that they got all the package together. BigQuery actually now is a data platform with the vector embeds and the capability and all the multimodal reasoning. It's looking really like a viable platform, scalable. I found that was my favorite little nuance point, is that BigQuery with the data there is really set up well, and they have tons of stuff around it, analytics and databases. The Gemini product is phenomenal. I actually did a little test. I said, is SiliconANGLE an influential publication? Because, you know, everyone's trying to figure out who's influential. Of course, the analyst relations department at Google's struggling with that as well. And others, and it said yes, they are extremely, and the answer wasn't generic stuff. It was specific to our business. It was really, really good. I was blown away. Of course, I did the vanity search, you know, who's John Furrier, and then it gives you who it is, and they said I worked at Oracle and VMware. So stellar career at Oracle and VMware. No, IBM and HP, they got it wrong there. Close, big corporate company. And then I started putting in stuff around things that I knew about in the industry, and it gives you a good answer. And then it gives you reasons why, evidence. So that's Perplexity that does the same thing, which I like. And we do it with our RAG system. So I think this multimodal thing is huge, Dave. This cross modality reasoning is going to be the real AI. And I think, like our last conversation on theCUBE, which people loved, I thought I'd tie it here, is that during the early days of the web, you had web pages. And you had search engines. Here in AI, you're going to have big power, highly capable, smart things, mechanisms, not just a search engine, but like technology that's built by people who are really deep tech engineering. And then you can have users of AI, like the web page. So it's very clear to me at Google is that that's happening. And the consulting businesses are booming as well. And what's happening there is that, unlike the old IT transformation projects, the new consulting system integrators are doing coding. They're actually engineering stuff on behalf of the customers. So that is a major differentiator for the ones that have engineering talent, because, you know, the companies need to move fast with AI by board pressure. And so they're putting pressure on the management of these companies and saying, where's our AI strategy? We need more growth. And they got to hire people to build it. So we saw this with the web too. Remember the old interactive shops? I'll build your web page for you. Very similar concepts going on here. So, you know, Google is going to be a supplier. They have all the chops. The one area that I was impressed on, but still I feel is going to be an opportunity to keep an eye on for Google, is their ecosystem. A lot of people were there with booth, big names, but I think they still need another year to make sure to validate that. So I think Google should make sure this year their focus is 100% on making sure the ecosystem doesn't fail. They have to make the ecosystem work by driving business through those partners, helping those partners, and then getting business for themselves as well. So if the ecosystem fails with Google Cloud, they'll never catch up to number two. They'll fall away in a distant third. And so I think that's my takeaway. And I think the partnerships are good, but there's a little bit of cognitive dissonance in the air with the partnerships.
It depends on the layer of the stack, right? Again, this is something else Slootman told me. It's like, you know, Google actually wasn't Slootman. I think it was Scarpelli said that Google, that really doesn't that friendly doing business. Now that was with Snowflake because they get BigQuery and BigQuery is awesome. And it's really head to head with Snowflake. But I wanted to go back. I just got to tell you a quick, make you laugh for a second. Before Gemini, when it was Bard, I asked, I was vanity, you know, barding and searching like, who's Dave Vellante? It said that I started SiliconANGLE with Jason Calacanis, which is hilarious. I mean, you had a background with Calacanis, right? You guys used to work, you know,
he was a producer at PodTech, my podcasting company. He did podcasts.
So maybe that's how it connected the dots. Who knows?
He's a prolific media person. I mean, Jason has roots with his newsletter. That's how he got in the business. And then he started Weblogs Inc., which was the original Engadget. It was the first real tech blog that rocked it. And then,
so maybe it was confusing you with Calacanis. But then the second thing I wanted to say
is easy to confuse.
So I was in Texas this week. I was in Houston, saw HPE and saw Fidel Maruso, Pat Osborne was down there, although you can connect with them. Jim Jackson I went down to see him, but he was busy, so I just kind of waved. Jason Newton and guys. But then I went to, drove over to Austin, and I met with the CFO of Yvonne and Rob Williams. And I saw Michael, which is kind of interesting, but I also saw Matt Baker.
Michael Dell, you mean?
Michael Dell.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I also saw Matt Baker, and we were shooting the shit like we always do. Matt,
our favorite Matt Baker, AI Matt Baker.
Yeah. AI Matt Baker.
Yeah, he's all over the whole RAG stuff. He loves the AI game right now. He's really been digging in hard. I love his.
Oh my God.
I love his LinkedIn posts are phenomenal.
He's unbelievable. I mean, because Matt Baker, for those who don't know him, he used to run strategic planning at Dell. And then when the whole AI thing took off, they said, okay, Matt, they hired or they brought back Vivek Mahindra to take Matt's job on strategic planning. And they said, Matt, you go figure out AI. So now he's like charging ahead with AI. And every time you meet him, he's like I think the last time I saw him was November and we were talking. And then since then, you know, he goes out and does all this research. He's doing a bunch of internal stuff. He's learned so much. Basically, I'm talking to the CFO of Dell, Yvonne and Rob, and talking to Matt Baker and certainly Michael, but I'm convinced that Dell, because they're like, you know, nearly $100 billion company, they're doing some really interesting stuff in AI that could put them ahead of a lot of their customers, which is rare for Dell, right? Usually Dell's, you know, they're selling boxes and they're going into customers and the financial services guys are telling them what they need. I think the reverse is happening where, you know, Dell's learning a lot because they're investing a lot. They have such a big company. They realize, wow, if we drive AI, we're going to drop money to the bottom line. So doing a lot of cool stuff with RAG. And Matt's right. We were talking about a lot of customers haven't figured out how easy RAG is to do. And, you know, he was pointing to us. He goes, well, you guys did RAG. Of course, you're like way ahead of the curve. He was pointing to us. But he asked me a really interesting question. And I wanted to ask you, because we were talking about Google. And I'm saying, hey, how about AWS? They're going to have Olympus. And Microsoft's got OpenAI, and the data suggests they're running away with it, like we just talked about. He said, yeah, but, you know, there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on with Llama. And you said about this when we talked about the Gen AI power law. He said, don't you think that open source is going to win? That all this proprietary stuff is, at some point, the customer's going to say, well, wait, why am I going to pay, you know, monopoly prices when I can get just as good a functionality? I could do mass customization with open source.
What's the question?
Don't you think open source is going to ultimately win all these closed systems? And what's going to happen to these closed systems? Anthropic, Olympus. Let me just, one more thing. It's a really interesting question I've been having with leaders. Like, will these LLMs become commoditized? One school of thought says, absolutely. We talked about this last week. The other school of thought says, no. They won't. So then there's that dimension, and then there's the open versus closed dimension. So piece that all together for me.
Well, we talked about last week on the pod about commoditization. I thought you agreed with the thesis. It's sometimes when people say commoditization, they're talking about something different. So when something's commoditized, what does that mean? That means it's a common thing. It's not as expensive. It's cheaper. It gets lower in value. It's everywhere. It's commodity. And then commodities change based on scarcity, right? And or volume, what abundance there is, demand, supply. So I think with LLMs, these foundation models, that world is growing and changing so fast that the commoditization is not really the question, because there's so much growth and value in these models that they're changing. So the question is to ask is who's more obsolete? Who's obsolete? Who's not? Who's better? If someone's not good at their LLM, they're not going to do business. They'll have a bad experience. I think our power law research that we put out, where you have that power law, and at the top of the power law in volume size of model, is definitely where the big players are. And we call them proprietary. That's the original name for them. Some call them pioneering models, but they don't like the word proprietary, because AI is open in their name. So like, they don't want to be labeled as proprietary, because that's pejorative. It means
Sam Altman said he wished he didn't take that name. Did you hear him say that?
No, I never. Of course.
Yeah. He said, in retrospect, I wish we didn't call ourselves OpenAI. Saying we're not open.
I know. Well, of course, everyone knows that, but that's the whole point. That's just optics. In our computer industry, being proprietary means you're owning it. You don't want anyone else to get it. And you're selfish. And open source software is open. So then the question that that Matt's asking is, will open source win, or will open win? Open always will win. It's like the right to choose. Okay. You know, that debate that goes on, sort of, you know, women's rights to choose, you know, you can't put that back the way it was. It's never going to change. I think so. I think that discussion is a pretty political one. It's happened in our business. It's become political. Proprietary is bad. Okay. Open is better. Open will always win. You can be proprietary, and the normalcy of privacy, proprietary is I own it. Land. It's proprietary. You have a deed on your house, right? You have land. You own it, right? That's proprietary to you. That's not a bad thing. That's just called ownership. So ownership of something is bad. So the word proprietary means I built it, I own it. Means no one else can co-own it. You could use it and I charge you a fee for it. That's not open source software. So that's where the proprietary name got associated, because it was the default conversation. OpenAI built their own model. They own it. They spend millions and millions of dollars to do that. And that's that. Where Matt Baker's getting at is that open source models are getting just as much traction and functionality and adoption as those proprietary funded for business companies, which means it's not as expensive and it's open. So that's a good thing. So that is going to put pressure on the big guys that have spent all that money to do one of two things. Make it commodity in the sense of, okay, it's commodity, use it. It's not as good as everyone else, got hallucinations, and I'll make as much money as I can till it dies. It's a race to the bottom. Or they could say, let's pour more money into it as a proprietary business and make it better. And that's what they have to do. So when we were talking about it, I said, if anyone's going to be commoditized, it's going to be the big LLMs. That was my answer. Matt Wood agreed. On LinkedIn, he pinged me. So the big guys are going to be proprietary. Because as you go down the power law, the smaller models actually are around people's data. And that's proprietary. And that's not bad. That's a good thing, because I own my thing. Now, open source software is going to adopt open models that can be programmed with. So that's kind of the way I see it. And I think what Matt Baker's smart about is that he knows that staying open will give them the best price performance, because open source tends to be free. Now, what will happen with these open source models, just like in open source, a company will form around it to support it, to provide what Red Hat did. So, you know, we used to ask, is there a Red Hat for the cloud? What was that? We would always say, is there a Red Hat for big data? Well, guess what? There could be one coming soon. I think that was a no a decade ago, but there could be a Red Hat for AI, in the sense of, if open source continues to get more popular, if you look at Hugging Face, look at the leaderboards, you know, Mistral, Llama, all the open source models are doing great. Why? Because there's a huge appetite demand for them, Dave. So if anything, that's commodity, because it's free.
Well, I think, yeah. I think open source, but I think, But I think to your point, as long as there's innovation, there's probably not going to be commoditization. I think Matt's other point was, look, it's about mass customization, and open source is going to support that mass customization, you know, at massive scale. So I don't know. It's an interesting.
Let me ask you a question, because you know, because I saw some of these fake analysts out there, you know, talking about, you know, stuff that they're paying customers. One of them said NVIDIA is a monopoly. Or is it a mop? Is not a monopoly.
Oh, I was going to say, yeah.
Let me find the tweet.
NVIDIA is a monopoly. NVIDIA is, of course, NVIDIA is a monopoly. I mean, the question with NVIDIA is not whether or not it's a monopoly. It is. I mean, it's got, where else are you going to get a GPU, the class of what they make? You know, you saw Intel trying to do, you know, Gaudi and doing some benchmarks against NVIDIA's previous generation, but Blackwell's not out yet.
Do you think NVIDIA's a monopoly?
Yes. Of course. Yes, absolutely. I mean, they've got, you know, over probably 80% share of the high-end GPU market, maybe it's closer to even 100%. They've got complete pricing power. They've got 77% gross margins. They've got a one-year backlog. If you don't write a check to them for $10 million, they're not even going to return your phone calls. You're never going to see a GPU. So that's a monopoly. So the question is, are they going to keep their monopoly, and how are they going to keep their monopoly? How long is it? I saw this consortium that's getting together that said they'd have sort of CUDA equivalent functionality by the end of the year. I'm like, well, wait a minute. CUDA was first shipped like more than 15 years ago. You're not going to compress 15 years into 1 year. Now, maybe they can, you know, more narrowly apply it and compete. I mean, the whole industry wants competition for NVIDIA. I want to see competition for NVIDIA. But, you know, their packaging, the Mellanox move that they made years ago, it's going to take a long time for people to unseat that. We know, we sat through Charlie Cowis's presentation at Broadcom. We know what their strategy is with Ultra Ethernet. And where they're winning with, you know, connectivity. But it's going to take a long time for the XPU folks to catch up, in my opinion, to NVIDIA. I think they will have a monopoly for at least in this market for at least 5 years. It could be longer. It could be a 10-year monopoly.
I just find it's embarrassing that analysts who get paid by Intel and these other companies saying it's not a monopoly because they want to give hope, I guess, to the...
Is that why they say it? Because they're trying to help Intel?
Well, they're either incompetent or they're being paid or both. So look at... But
that's why Intel doesn't invite me to their... I said, Pat Gelsinger, I love Pat Gelsinger. We know each other. We've always had great interviews. We've had debates and arguments.
You think that's
why they don't invite me to their stuff? Because we've been so right and critical of...
I don't think they know you exist. You gotta go knock on their door. I mean, they're closed for
business.
Oh yeah, Intel's closed for business. They're hiding the ball. Well, when you don't have anything, you close the doors and you put window dressing around it, right? So if they're not inviting you to their analyst meeting, they don't want you in the kingdom because you're gonna probably discover stuff that's bad, right? So that's, you know, independent analysts do that, right? So they think you're already briefed. They don't want to waste a seat. Get someone else that's not up to speed. They want to train someone else. Or they just not competent. I don't know. There's a variety of reasons for that, but we're clearly covering it. You're covering it. So, you know, the reason why is that most people don't do things because they're either have dogma or some other religion around how they do things, or they don't want smart people in their camp. Okay. And, you know, I remember having this conversation with the top Amazon people years ago. They're like, hey, you guys we want to work with you because you know the most, and we want you to understand our story so that, you know, all these people throwing haymakers on the internet, you can at least be objective and tell the truth when it's time to like step up and say, no, it's not true. Because when companies have conjecture and make statements and hire people to be a mouthpiece for that conjecture, okay, that, and they're in the media, then what happens is customers will think that's real or not real, and then there's a credibility gap there. But if a company says they do X and customers think that's not true, then you don't want the analysts that talk to customers in the media saying, wait, you're lying. It's wrong. What you're saying doesn't match what customers know or think about what you do. Or worse, if the third party data doesn't back it up. So I've found that when you have strict command and control PRAR teams, the ones that aren't talking mean something's wrong. And that's classic marketing, Dave. You don't market when you're not good. And that's what's going on, I think, at Intel. They're they're not doing well. They're licking their wounds. They had a big loss. You know, as I said this last week, and companies that are trying, they don't want to amplify bad performance.
Yeah, well, there's plenty of data out there on Intel. It's easy. I mean, I watch the keynotes and the presentations, and you know, I work with Florian. Florian and I are doing a breaking analysis soon on just doing one of our semiconductor updates, and we'll address this. I mean, personally, I'm not going to chase Intel, but I'll chase NVIDIA. I want to spend
my philosophy is that they probably shouldn't invite you because you're already briefed.
Yeah,
you're already on top of it. You know, so maybe they feel they don't need to educate you. I don't know.
Yeah,
I
mean, could be.
I don't want to get into that now because you know there's so much that this whole analyst ranking stuff has been a real black eye for the industry.
What do you mean? Those sites that rank?
Yeah, I had a conversation with the CEO of AR Insights yesterday morning with a bunch of other analyst firms, and I was saying, "Hey, I see a lot of bad behavior. People using rankings and gaming the rankings so they can put that into their contracts." And so that's not how the industry works. So, you know, it's not being monitored. It's an honor system in the industry analyst world. You know that more than anyone. You've been an analyst all your career. I'm just new to it. And like that, you know, this is weird. That guy's not number one in his analyst relations. He's not number two.
I didn't even know what this thing was until somebody mentioned it to me. And I was like, am I on there? I drop research every week. And so I emailed those people. And I said, hey, do you count my stuff as a blog or as a research? And they said, blog. And I'm like, well, what's the difference? And I'm like, look at what I write. It's like data, it's survey work, it's analytics. And they're like, well, this is research. And I was like, okay, well, you should count it as research. All of a sudden I hit the list. I don't know. Tweet more, I'm on it.
These lists started as, remember the clout ranking?
Yeah. Clout ranking was a joke.
That was good at first. Then it'd be like, oh, number of followers and make your reach. I'll just buy more followers.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You could just game it. You could easily game it. Yeah.
So, but a lot of these lists start as promotional elements. So this AR Insights company has a business model to service analyst relations departments. So what they do is they have software that they sell a service, their core business, to analyst relations departments, meaning helping them with things like organizing news and having like a SaaS service. That's actually a good business model. I actually like it.
Yeah.
I think it's important for the industry. Mm-hmm. And the leaderboard came in as more of a way of a list. Here's some top analysts you could work with. So it ended up being a list of the people who are the best for getting paid, who will pay to get work. So if I'm looking for someone to build a deck on my house, I got the yellow pages. Who's the best, cheapest deck builder for me? That's highest quality for me. And that's what this list is. It became a list of people who are who I can hire to market. And I can pay them for services, not who's the best analyst. It's who's the best at taking cash and doing whatever I want. That's what it is. So I told them that list is hurting their reputation, that they should kill the list or recreate the list and recategorize it and look at real research. And then they said something funny. You'll get a kick out of this. They said, and it was a legit comment because it was an old school kind of mentality. Well, the media citations are critical. I go, okay, so if I put my name on every SiliconANGLE blog post, we are media. Well, also, how many times they're on TV? Well, we are TV. clearly the metrics are not there to do these lists, Dave. There's no data. And so what turned out as a marketing opportunity for this good company, AR Insights, actually made the list more like PR Insights. Who will get paid to do public relations for you? So I think they're going to fix it. The CEO was very cool. Their community person's really, really nice. I really liked her. She's really friendly and very smart. And they're listening. And I got to give them a lot of props. They listened. And they're going to make changes. So AR Insights is going to make changes to their algorithm or maybe even discontinue the list. I told them they should do like what Net Promoter Score does, do surveys.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't really understand the stuff. I was just looking at the list and I was like, some good analysts on there. But I don't know. I don't know how it works. I don't really care. I just, I want to keep doing good work and serving our audience.
I won't name names, but being exposed in our area of the industry, we've been 13, 14 years going to events and being involved in all the analyst relations programs out there and PR with theCUBE. we see all the analysts every day. And I can tell you, I personally can spot the difference between a good analyst and a bad analyst out of the box. And then over time, you say, consistently, you see the winners. Like, you know who the players are. It's like people who put on a good game on the field. It's like sports. You know, you can see the athletes. You can see what they do. And you're like, wow, that person looks good coming out of the tunnel, but doesn't do well on the field. Right? That's obvious. And so, again, I think the industry is going through a lot of change. Media in general, Dave, is going through a lot of change. And I'll tell you right now, what's going on with theCUBE and SiliconANGLE is really exciting, because as we get more TV and the AI clips coming out, and as we get these events, more blanket coverage with team coverage, the performance of the engagement is off the charts, and the content coverage is phenomenal. At Google Next, just as an example, I know you were traveling some of these NDA meetings in the industry, but I'll tell you, we had great production, we had great storytelling, we had great news analysis, we had great news writing, Rob and his team. We had 10 stories on our site before I even did one interview after the keynote, 10. And then I think we had now over 30 to 40 different stories on there, and more is coming. We're going to have over 500 clips. When you get the right team and focus on these events, it's really amazing how in real time, the ability to acquire, the ability to program and distribute the content with digital is phenomenal. And the combination of our multimodal capabilities with SiliconANGLE, theCUBE, and CUBE Research, and the platform is really coming together. I got to tell you, it's so exciting to see, because it's like watching performances go up. Multimodal is the hottest thing in AI right now. And we just got lucky that we do multimodal media programming. So I got to tell you, it's super exciting for me and looking at this, because we think about this for years, right? We're like, oh, hey, we should do more videos. You know, we should do more research. Pull it all together, build a platform. Well, guess what?
We did.
Google now has tools for everyone else to do it too. So, and it's going to make us and everyone stronger. So I think you're going to see a whole new media landscape. I think this whole digital subscriptions will continue. Like, the information does great work. I see those reporters, they're phenomenal. But that's not going to be the only game in town. I think you're going to see a mix of new monetization models kick in on scale, high quality, truth-telling, storytelling, news analysis, getting people featured, personal stories, customer case studies. I mean, customer case studies was always viewed as in media as, it's not really news. But on digital, when you feature a customer success story and you tie it with news, it flies around. It really distributes, because the people are involved in it. You got the person who's the customer, they're seeing story about their environment. You got the people who deliver the solution and make the products involved. So social networks allow you to bring this neural vibe to the table, this network effect that has people involved who amplify their own stories, so the good content spreads around. So
I wonder if we should talk about that our business and how it's changing on one of the CUBE pods. You know, Rafael Meyerson, you'd know him if you saw him. He pinged me and said, you know, we'd like to learn. I listened to the CUBE pod. I like it. I'd like to learn more about how you and John got started, how you see the business evolving, what your business is like, changes in the business. I mean, you have a lot of good perspectives. I'd like to. I think people might dig some of that, you know, inside baseball, you know. But anyway.
I think, first of all, yeah, definitely. Because one, it is, I think it's good to know what the origination story is. But I tell you right now, it's not just telling the story. People want to know what we're doing because they want to work with us. We haven't been really good about marketing it. So what my big walk away again this year and these events, and especially Google Next, is that we actually have more capabilities to get paid than we thought. So customers value certain elements of our business model. So what's exciting is that you're going to start to see, we'll see some new stuff come out, and that's going to be fun to talk about. But again, the most important thing is how to get the content out and scale content that's quality, that hits the mark where the demand is. Google Next, you search Google Next, SiliconANGLE, theCUBE, you'll see all the stories. It's awesome. And guess what? It's all important, because it's not Google saying write about us, because Google's having an event. It's like covering the game. They're making moves on stage. You got to cover the touchdowns, Dave, you know, if they're making good plays, the commentary is easy when it's happening right in front of you. So to me, again, I think media is changing, and more importantly, the ability to make money to fund better talent is coming into clear view, and it's going to be fun to see how this all plays out. So again, I'm super psyched, and again, what we did with theCUBE this week, we did another first. I did a live remote hit to New York Stock Exchange TV at lunch on day three of Google Next and did a event roundup. So if you go to NYSE on Google, you'll see April 12th, the Friday edition. My segment was aired. Actually, it wasn't a live hit. It was pre-recorded that went live in their program. And it was essentially at the end of the segment where they go, let's go to John Furrier for what's going on at Google Next, a really big player in the cloud business. And they asked great questions. You know, Trinity, their host, was like, are they catching up? And like, you know, just really easy to do. And then did the interview because it was short. And then I went back to the, doing more Cuban interviews.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's all good.
That's great. Well, and we got, let's see, next week we're at SAS, right? In Vegas. You and I, we'll be together. That's yeah. Ironic. We didn't do Google Next together. We'll do SAS next week. Be awesome.
Well, we'll have to get the numbers. I'll put the published the numbers from Google Next. Well, Dave, great pod. Again, a lot of energy lost this week. I'm tired. I'm burnt out right now. I had
you guys did a great job, yeah. John. Congratulations. I mean, what an awesome team. You, Savannah, yeah. Rob, Rebecca, Dustin, you guys were terrific. I felt like I was there. I was able to catch up on all the news. I'd watch at night after I got back, and it was great
just,
job. Well,
everyone just did an amazing job, and you know, and Google was leaning in. So, and what's great about these events when Google brings talent to the set, brings us access to the execs, it's awesome. And these were execs that had something to say. It wasn't just scripted talking points, Dave. So that was really good. And two, we have a lot of friends at Google now. And you've got to remember, Kubernetes is 10 years old. And we've been covering Google as an industry. We know people from Silicon Valley. But more important, that Kubernetes team and the Google management team, this is a big part of their cloud strategy, right? And so it's fun to see people that we've been kind of, you know, on a journey with over the past decade have position power to make build Google Cloud, but also we know them. We knew them before they were famous, so it's great to see them successful, and they're happy for us too. So again, I was pretty pumped. It's very similar vibe to AWS from when we around 2015 2016 vibe with Amazon Web Services. Remember that feeling where we knew them before they were super popular, all the management team and the people building it out, and then it became like really popular and everyone wanted a piece of them, and we were just one of the team members. We're like a team member. It felt good. The similar type thing happening at Google. But all right, more of that later. And next time we'll try to get Andy Jassy on. I'm going to hit him up, see if he comes on.
Be great. Love to have Andy.
Dave, have a great weekend.
Thanks, John.
If you're listening, hey, if you like us, drop us a note on LinkedIn or Twitter. Go to siliconangle.com. That's where all the traffic is. Cube.net is where all the videos are stored. What's where the event's going to be. And some goodies there, Cube Alumni Database, and a lot more stuff. And, of course, the cubeai.com. Check it out. That's our language model, proprietary language model. You can say it's
our RAG.
our retrieval augmentation generation. Say that 10 times. All right, Dave. See you later.
All right, John. Thanks. See you. Bye.